rapid succession of animal eyes. BBC Natural World. It's morning, and a heavy mist rolls slowly over a stretch of glassy water. The current flows past a buoy, while the fog drifts along in the same direction. In silhouette, a man paddles his canoe through the peaceful scene. Two birds float together, shaking their heads in an almost dance-like sequence. Colin Stafford Johnson.
Early mornings for me are some of the best times. The dawn chorus comes and the reeds are full of bird song, and it's a wonderful, happy time.
The fiery globe of the sun hangs low and large above the horizon. Then a swan, who's half submerged with its feet in the air, elegantly cranes its neck up from the depths. Small birds titter on stalks of reeds.
It's a great time to be on the river. It's time to find food because you've been building up an appetite all night. Time to find a mate. A time to declare your intentions. This is still my patch. This is my part of this riverbank.
With the waterway bathed in an orange glow, Colin's gently paddling near two ducks.
It's a wonderful, peaceful time of day. When the light, if you're out there at sunrise, sometimes the light is so, so special.
Underwater, Colin's canoe passes overhead, briefly blocking out the sun as it dapples the water. On a wide stretch of river, Colin's canoe is a mere dot, leaving a faint wake.
There aren't many really wild places left in this country, but on the Shannon River, you still get that feeling no one's ever been there before. I want to see this river in all its moods, in every season. Not just how it looks, but how it sounds, how it feels. I want to find the hidden places and the hidden creatures living there.
A kingfisher dives in slow motion. A frog's throat sac expands and contracts, and a wing of swans fly high in the sky. A shrimp with claws open and extended on the riverbed. A fish swimming over dense weeds. Then the startling predatory eyes of a fox.
I'm going to have no fixed agenda. Just want to wander. Wander and explore.
Water burbling in an eddy, then splashing on a rocky overhang.
This river is a lifeline for countless creatures who shelter in and around its waters. I'm going to follow them, see where they take me.
Ireland's wild river. The mighty Shannon. In time-lapse footage, flowerheads spring open and unfurl. Colin's sketching.
Spring on the Shannon. The great awakening. And there's such a sense of purpose in the air. The orange-tipped butterfly is one of the first of the season, and it's a real sign that spring is here. Just a couple of months ago, all this was underwater. And then the water recedes, and they sort of appear out of nowhere and colonize these watery meadows. They're the most perfect little creature. The wings are so delicate, and the colors are so rich. The two sexes are quite different. The female doesn't have those lovely orange tips. These must be some of the most beautiful natural wildflower meadows left in the country. Never seen herbicides or pesticides. It's just the way this rough grassland, farmland used to look in Ireland. The landscape really hasn't changed, but there is something missing. This place should be resounding to the cries of the wading birds, the lapwing and the curlew, and the ring plover and the redshank. But they've all gone. They've all disappeared within about the last 20 or 30, 40 years. Some people blame the mink for this emptiness. Ground nesting birds, their little chicks and the eggs have no protection against a predator like that. But you know, nature tends to be more complex than that. The real reason sometimes for the rise and fall of different creatures can be very hard to identify. Our countryside has changed dramatically in the last few decades, and I guess the river is just reflecting that change.
On the river under a partly cloudy sky.
Now you can travel for mile upon mile on this river and never hear the sound of the curlew or the call of the lapwing or the whistle of the redshank. It's all gone.
Gliding over still waters, brushing past reeds.
It's very, very few and far between. There are one or two places left on the river where they still nest successfully.
Port Runny, County Roscommon.
Now these low-lying fields are known as the callows. This is exactly what birds like curlew and redshank and lapwing need to breed, and that is the warning call of a redshank. He says, I'm too close. And it's a call that just says, potential danger. Await further instructions. Now, if I was to get close, if I was to get out of the boat, you'd hear a very different call. And that other call is a real warning. It says, not only have we spotted danger, but we actually have to react to it right now. And it's a particular call they make, a sort of a lovely, fluty whistle. And that tells the chick to go straight for cover. They're relying completely on the parents' vigilance. People sometimes call them the guard dogs of the callows. I have a friend who lives in a remote part of the west of Ireland, and the only way to get to his house is on foot. And he can always tell if there are visitors on the way because he'll hear that redshank calling and he'll know there'll be a knock on his door 10 minutes later.
A broad-shouldered man, Colin smiles towards the sun with rosy cheeks.
I don't see this as a journey from source to sea. I see it very much as a wander around the entire system. I want to be on different parts of the river at different times of the year.
A dense flock of birds silhouetted by a golden sun suddenly take flight into the clear sky.
I've lived in Ireland most of my life, and I guess the Shannon is something I feel I've taken for granted. I mean, this is the longest river in Britain and Ireland, and it divides our country in two, from sort of the wilder west to the gentler east. You have this feeling of crossing the Shannon. You know you're going to another part of the country. It reminds you of how time passes and the lives that were once here, and you have to sort of wonder, what will we leave behind?
A family of deer with a fawn, their breath condensing in the cold air.
Will the monoliths of the Celtic tiger look as romantic as the castle ruins?
A hawk's caught a mouse.
I don't think so.
A large flock of birds fly in front of the sun as it dips below a tree line. It's dusk, and Colin's sitting and listening at his campsite by the river, a small fire glowing near his tent and canoe. A reflection of the moon appears to dance in undulating water. Tiny sharp claws emerge from a crevice in a rock face as light shimmers from nearby water. A small bat gradually makes its way out while Colin walks in the dark, a lantern held aloft. He focuses on the bat and sidesteps around. The bat squeaks. It takes flight in slow motion.
Bats are one of the most unappreciated of creatures. There are so many nasty stories associated with bats. When you hear these stories and you see the movies, it's always about vampires and giving them a bad reputation. And that somehow seems to get ingrained in our consciousness. They are utterly harmless to human beings, absolutely harmless. And they're not just harmless to us, they really benefit. I mean, any creature that goes around scooping up midges in their thousands is a friend of mine, because some nights on the river you'd wish you had an entire swarm of bats accompanying you every place you went. We have about 30 mammals in Ireland and 10 of them are bats. If only we could totally reverse the way that many of us see them and look at them as the incredibly well-adapted sort of ancient creatures that they are.
The bat swoops over still water, its leathery wings barely skimming the glassy surface at night.
These are the Benton's bats. They're known commonly as water bats. And that's because they are perfectly adapted for life on the river. If you look really closely, you can see the odd one just flitting by really fast. And what they are doing is they are hunting over the water surface. They are looking for little insects which are caught on the top of the water. As they struggle to free themselves from that surface tension, they make little ripples. And what the bats are doing now, they are echolocating, finding where those little ripples are coming from. And they can sort of scoop up the insects, either with their tail or with their feet. They have extra big feet, and they use those to just lift the struggling insect from the surface of the river. Flitting back and forth.
Its leathery wings in slow motion.
The bats themselves live, I guess, in a different world. They perceive the world in a different way to me. Although their eyesight is as good as mine, it's not much good to you when you're flying about in the dark. So as they fly up and down the river, they have their mouths wide open and they are effectively sort of screaming at the water and waiting for that echo to come back. And that's how they discern their environment. That's how they see where they're going. They like to hunt in the calm stretches of the river because if the surface is too disturbed, they wouldn't be able to locate their prey. They're incredible aerial acrobats, constantly scanning the surface.
Flying with its mouth open.
Incredible creatures. Beautiful creatures.
Colin paddles across the river with moonlight glinting off the rippled surface. It's daytime and raindrops are falling on leaves and flower heads in slow motion. The petals give way as globules of water splash down and a mayfly is knocked from its perch on a leaf. Colin's standing under a tree with his backpack.
This weather's really tough on the creatures that live off the river. Now, this wind has been really continuously blowing now for over a month. Not quite what I had in my mind's eye when I set out on this journey. I imagine those lovely, fine April evenings as the days start to lengthen. Just listening to the birds singing, maybe sitting by a little campfire. But for the last 4 or 5 weeks, I've just been huddled down like all the other creatures, waiting for this spell of weather to pass on. This year, this weather came at just the wrong time. There should be great hatches of insects, and not just for the birds, but for the fish and everything too. They, you know, everything is feeding voraciously at this time of year. You know, for nesting birds, it's not just that the parents might not be able to supply their chicks with enough food, but the chicks get actively hammered by the wind and the rain.
A bird in the grass.
But then it'll be amazing if the conditions do pass. On the first sunny morning, the whole place will just come alive again.
A brightly coloured rainbow arcs over the shore of the river as choppy water flows by. Three energetic chicks with gaping mouths reach out of their nest as a parent feeds them. Inside a partially hatched egg, a tiny chick stirs. The The sun silhouettes the launching of dozens of dandelion seeds blown from a stalk in the breeze. In clear blue sky, dozens of mayfly have taken flight. A parent nests with their hungry chicks, and two kingfishers mate on a thin branch. The hatchling rests, its shell broken beside its moist body, while its sparse gold feathers glint in the sunlight. A mayfly floats past on the river, its wings stuck to the water. It flaps quickly and rises a few centimetres into the air before falling again. After another failed attempt, it flutters upwards and joins its fellow insects, filling the air in their thousands. A solitary mayfly launches against a backdrop of the sun. Collins paddling on the shores of Loch Allen.
It's nothing like travelling on a river. There's just that feeling of sort of peace and tranquility. You can kind of drift in and out of animals' lives and they don't even know you've been there. You don't disturb them.
It's a bright day and fluffy white clouds dot the faint blue sky. A small disturbance under the surface sends out a ripple.
When I'm paddling my canoe, I'm just wondering what's happening beneath me. That whole cycle of life, things meeting and mating and breeding and things killing each other, that's all happening in the water, but there's something that's hidden to us. There's one fish that's found throughout this river system, seldom seen, but at this time of year, their presence becomes obvious. And that's because it's mating time. People call them the barracuda of the Shannon. It's very much the creature that if you were a fish, you'd want to avoid. They're superbly adapted for their environment. They can move very, very fast if they have to. Any fish that comes within striking range has no chance whatsoever. Some people look at predators as being cruel and this sort of thing, but it's really not the case. If you're an animal that's been injured in nature, be you a deer in a forest, if you've got a tiger around, a tiger will kill an injured deer. If it breaks a leg, instead of dying slowly, tiger will spot it and kill it. And the pike are sitting there at the bottom of the lake. They're just not randomly chasing any fish. They're looking for the ones which are moving a bit slowly or aren't doing so well. So they're maybe they're sort of like an anesthetic, or they put people out of their misery. They put fish out of their misery.
A pike's startled and rapidly swims into the murky depths.
Right now, food is the last thing on their mind. They're just thinking about making babies. What the females are actually doing is they're laying their eggs on those little bits of reeds, and they will lay thousands of eggs. But they'll only last there for a few hours, and then they'll fall onto the gravel bed. So you sort of wonder, why do they lay them on the reeds in the first place? Maybe it's because the eggs are more likely to be fertilised in mid-water. Must be something like that.
Pikes slipping over one another at the surface.
The males are just hugging the females, waiting for her to decide to spawn. I mean, they're just going to hang with her as close as they can because they'll get a very limited opportunity to become daddies.
Three males are rubbing flanks against a female as she swims over a bed of weeds. Then a sudden spurt of energy as they pursue her.
When that opportunity arises, when she's ready to spawn, that's what they've been waiting for. It's that moment. They've got to be right in there, and that's what that splashing's all about.
Fins flap at the surface, sending splashes of water several feet into the air. Some of the pikes slip and slide over each other, their fins flipping powerfully in the water. A patch of bubbles rise and disperse. The waters are churned up as the mating continues. Colin watches with a smile filled with wonder. He paddles on in his green canoe, wearing a blue life preserver. Then he's drawing his boat onto a grassy bank on the island of Loch Ree.
People are always talking about climate and changing, and is it changing, and that sort of thing. And the natural world doesn't lie.
Walking in rubber boots.
You can see an increase in temperature. Things are moving north and west all the time because they're able to tolerate living in those sort of warmer conditions that are now on offer there.
Claws on the end of leathery bird feet perched on a branch.
So you get this gradual influx in species, and the Shannon is going to, you know, things were going to start being able to live here that couldn't live here before.
While Colin tramps through thick undergrowth, a white bird stares over its dark beak with beady grey eyes. It has a long neck, and on top of its head, two long thin plumes are blowing in the wind. Colin's in the dark below the treetops, looking up towards the canopy.
I remember the first time I saw egrets, it was in the south of Spain, and I thought they were the most exotic thing I'd ever seen. I was walking up in the hills and I came over by this little lake, and there were these beautiful, pure white birds wading around in the shallows. And I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing, and little did I know that within, I suppose, 20 years that those birds would have made it to Ireland, and they're breeding alongside our herons. That's something I never thought I'd see.
Egrets and a heron sharing a branch.
There's something about herons too. When you see them sort of hunched up, they can look sort of a little bit angry, a little bit sort of fed up with life. The egrets are like the new beautiful cousins have just come along, and they're kind of taking their limelight or something, and they seem to put up with them. But the egrets, I guess, are just so much more elegant.
An egret scratches the top of its head with its foot.
Everything seems very calm. It's as if they've been living together all their lives. The two species seem to sort of accept each other's presence, even though they must be in competition for feeding sites and nesting sites. My guess is there's so many fish in the river that there's no big competition.
Colin's looking up at an occupied egret nest with a heron perched nearby.
Sound. One of the parents has just come in, and they're all just going for it. It's a real survival of the fittest. All the chicks have to be on their feet, as it were, and scrambling for food, and that's what it's known as, scramble competition. You've got to make your presence known to your parents so that you'll be fed, because if the parent doesn't spot you and you start missing out on your meals, you'll end up getting weak and not making it.
A small egret laying down.
My fear is that little guy has no chance. No future.
It looks around feebly.
Sad. Nature can be tough.
Colin moves on through the forest. An intricate spiderweb catches sunlight and waves in a light breeze. Taking flight, an egret stretches its neck and beats its wings. Another egret is perched on the end of a branch, its head retracted to its body, while its feathers ripple in the wind. Colin's paddling on still waters, which reflect a hazy orange sky stretched out behind him. A pair of egrets are attempting to land on a branch, reaching into the sky above a treetop. Under the murky surface of the river, the canoe glides effortlessly overhead, sending out ripples from its sides. Colin's paddling past lily pads between the overgrown banks of Victoria Lock, south of Bernaher.
In my inner dumber air, Smeyim hi kashmara Sinsper chan chitel.
He stops paddling for a moment and simply gazes at something in the water before resuming his passage. Trees and bushes protrude into the course of the green-tinged river. The sun's casting beams around cloud near the horizon as Colin paddles through a marshy patch of water. From the seeded tops of reeds by the river to a golden sun dipping behind a hill, the edges of its hemisphere wavering in the heat.
We live in a country that's undergoing rapid change in the last 30, 40, 50 years. The landscape has changed fundamentally, and that's always happened a certain amount. It's just the speed of change has been dramatic. Animals aren't good at adapting to fast change like that.
Undulating ripples breaking up a reflection of the sun. Then Colin paddling out of the marsh, beyond a buoy, onto a glassy section of the river. A pair of swans swim in the orange evening light. Collins set up a campfire by the river at the meadows near Clonmacnoise. He's listening.
That's a sound now that's really rare in these parts. That's a corncrake. I remember the days when they were so common. They were found in pretty much every field in Ireland, and I used to listen to them just a few miles from Dublin city centre when I was growing up. But now they've really disappeared from so much of the country. When you cut silage, you cut it early in the season. So when you have a bird like the corncrake that nests in long grass, it's just gotten to the stage of finding a mate, and then females sitting on her nest, sitting on her eggs. And that's when the grass cutters arrive. So they don't have time to raise their young. So year on year, corncrakes have just disappeared all over the country, and they happen very quickly. And here on the Shannon, they've been making a bit of a stand down on the Shannon Callows, probably because that land was used a little less intensively than other parts of the country. And unfortunately, they've done really badly the last few years. And I've heard this year that there's actually just one male left calling. He's calling to establish a territory, but to let a female know that he's about. Because if you're a corncrake wandering around in the deep grass, you can't find each other, so it's up to him to call in the female. And if there's a receptive female in the area, she should come and have a look at him. But it seems very likely, very possible, that there's no one out there for him. When I go to sleep tonight, there's a good chance when I wake up in the morning, that little guy is still going to be calling, because the only thing on his mind right now is finding a mate. That's why he's flown here all the way from Africa. He doesn't know that there aren't any other corncrakes here. He doesn't know that there aren't any females. Poor little guy out there now.
Looking at the fire.
He'd be calling all night. All day too, probably, if he doesn't have any luck.
After warming his hands for a few moments, he wafts the fire and the flames rise briefly, illuminating his sad face.
Shannon's going to flow through this area now and not hear that call again.
In time lapse, a brilliant yellow sun goes down, lighting up the clouds as they race across the sky. pinpoint stars slowly turn all the while above a church and graveyard. Brighter stars with blue halos flicker as clouds pass in front of them. It's dawn, and pink and purple clouds scud over the silhouetted ruin of a church wall. The sun rises, painting the sky yellow and orange as the river ebbs at a shore in time-lapse. Colin's guiding his canoe through marshy reeds in the morning.
It's like being in another world. Very peaceful, just the sounds of the reeds themselves blowing gently in the wind. But all this activity that's going on that's unseen, all the birds building the little platform, floating nests, sitting on eggs, chicks hatching, that's all going on now, all around here. Just by listening to the sounds, you can tell that's what's going on. None of the residents in here can see each other either. So that's why they're constantly calling, letting each other know where they are. Contact calling. It's lovely to hear.
A waterborne bird with its eggs.
There's always one animal every year that sort of somehow gets into your mind and that just starts to fascinate you. And for me, it's been the great crested grebe.
The grebe stands above his clutch of eggs and nestles down on top of them.
The eggs hatch on different days because as soon as the first egg is laid, the female starts incubating it.
The nest is at water level.
Both parents are very diligent. They have these amazing parental instincts.
As one of the parents warms the eggs, the other dives underwater and retrieves a leaf. It places it on the nest. The incubating mate takes another leaf and places it on the nest. Later, a black and white striped chick pokes its head out from the back of the grebe.
The little grebe chicks must be some of the cutest chicks on the river. They're beautiful little striped patterns, so different looking than their parents. Grebe parents will actually pluck their own feathers and feed them to the chicks. It's a remarkable thing to see.
Another chick has popped its head out, while the first has the feather firmly grasped in its jaw.
Beautiful birds.
A chick falls out from its place on the parent's back. It has dark stripes along its body and wings, as well as red growths on its nose. The parent lifts a wing, and the chick scrabbles back up into its resting spot. Colin's writing, "Love these little guys," in his sketchbook. Paddling at a fair pelt, Colin's staring across the dark blue expanse of the river. He set up his green tent in the daytime and sat down on a camping seat.
Amazing how the whole world seems to have gone silent now. It's every year, I notice around the 15th of July or so, it's as if someone had just flicked a switch. The Shannon is no difference. All the birds just stop making noise. And that's because the breeding season is over and they don't have to sing anymore. They don't any longer have to defend breeding territories. They don't have to attract females. There's no reason to sing, and that's why they've stopped. Because it really seems to happen over a matter of a week or so. It just suddenly just goes quiet. Absolutely quiet.
A kingfisher's perched on a curved branch, scratching behind its ear with its bright red claw. Its back is bright blue, from its neck to its tail feathers, while its breast is a mixture of orange and white. With dark blue wings and mottled blue scalp, the kingfisher dives into the river and comes back with a small fish. two other kingfishers watch as a third hurls itself like a javelin into the water before flapping back to the perch. One kingfisher gives its catch to another. Another has a wriggling fish clenched in its beak. With split-second speed, the kingfisher bashes the fish's head against a branch, then swallows it down whole. River Inni, Shannon Tributary.
The greatest angler on the river has got to be the kingfisher. They're just master fishermen. And they've got to be, because they can pretty much eat their own body weight in food every day. Most of the time, you just see a flash of blue. But to really see how beautiful they are, you've got to slow them down.
The hydrodynamically shaped kingfisher dives into the water at a tight angle. Its mouth is slightly open as it disappears beneath the water, spreading its wings beneath the splash. It's back out before most of the splash has had time to hit the surface. Another dive. Only this time its prey is putting up a fight and the kingfisher's struggling to keep a hold of it. Lifting the fish out of the water and beating its wings to gain some height, the kingfisher retains a precarious grip. Underwater, bubbles form around the kingfisher's head as it speeds towards its target. With pinpoint precision, a tiny fish is plucked from dozens of others on the riverbed, and the kingfisher immediately beats its wings, pushing them to the surface. Above the water, its wings sweep back and forth, alternating the orange of the underside with the topside's blue. It's evening, and Colin's reeling in the line of his fishing rod. He's caught a fish about the size of a large carrot. Grasping it tightly, he tucks the rod under his arm as he sets about unhooking it. The setting sun colours wispy clouds of burnt sienna and silhouette Colin, who wipes his mouth by his tent. He paddles his canoe along the dark river. Yellow flowers have opened in the sun and bob to and fro in a gentle breeze.
I'm starting to see subtle changes in colour on the riverbanks. Autumn isn't far away.
At the edge of a vast swathe of the river, dense foliage has taken on autumnal hues. Sunlight glints through a forest canopy, and brown leaves start to drift down to earth from jutting branches. A duck floats on the water, its head tucked away. A blue tit plucks a red berry from a branch, and a robin trills exuberantly. Colin makes his way up a rugged slope, winding his way in between slender tree trunks. As a twig snaps under his foot, it startles a velvet-coated deer which bounds off. A red squirrel with tufted ears is feasting on a nut.
Great to see the red squirrels around. The Shannon, which formed a barrier to people long ago, has been really important for the red squirrel in Ireland, because when someone decided in their wisdom to bring the greys here, the greys never actually managed to cross the Shannon. And so that's why the reds are still here. The poor little blighters, they just can't compete. It's not that the greys are physically fighting with them, it's just that they find the food quicker. And they'll take food that's still sort of raw nuts and that sort of thing. And these little guys just can't compete. And so the females don't put on enough weight, and so they don't breed. Since that earlier, I found some pine marten scat. There's some sort of evidence that maybe they are able to catch grey squirrels easier than reds. Reds are a little more agile. They can get to the outer branches of the trees, maybe where the pine martens can't get to them. It may be that with the rise of the pine marten again, that greys are going to be disadvantaged and the reds might make a comeback. I mean, that would be great if that happened. And it just might.
Colin gazes up at the treetops. Agile red squirrels race along fragile branches, then take flying leaps to land in neighbouring trees. A bough bends under the weight of a landing squirrel, but he scampers along the narrow branch and continues on his way. Another squirrel makes a huge leap, with a nut still held in its mouth. The squirrels land on slender twigs which look like they should snap on impact, but somehow they manage to time their jumps so that they're able to scurry along the branches before they can break. In slow motion, a squirrel curves its body and stretches out its claws in mid-air. Wispy cobwebs woven between grass stalks quiver in a breeze. Colin is paddling along the river. Beneath the surface, a shrimp stands poised on the shallow bed. It raises its claws as the canoe glides overhead. The sky is blood red and bare spindly branches have been cast into silhouette. Big Meadow, south of Athlone.
For anyone who spends time on the water, they'll know that sound. That's just the sound of the Shannon in winter. That wonderful, haunting sort of call, the sound of the hoopers arriving. The end of the autumn and beginning of winter is when they tend to arrive, and they've been chased from their northern breeding grounds by the cold weather up there. They fly south to avoid it. They come to the Shannon because there's a great big larder here to keep them going for the winter months. You don't have to watch swans taking off to see that flight doesn't really come all that naturally to them. They really have to push those bodies up into the air. You'd think that they'd be a bird that maybe couldn't fly all that far, but they can fly all the way from Iceland to here non-stop.
A swan in flight, beating its mighty wings and with its long neck outstretched.
Once you make a decision to undertake that flight, there's sort of no turning back, because you've nothing to turn back to, so no matter what obstacle they hit or what weather they hit, they just have to keep going.
A group of swans fly just a few feet above the surface of the river. They have mustard yellow beaks tipped with black, and their dark eyes are ringed with a line of pale yellow. Their legs are tucked in behind them.
They must be very, very pleased when they see the ribbon of the Shannon River from the air. Maybe they're calling because they're just happy to be here.
The white of the swan's feathers is startling bright against the backdrop of a crisp blue sky. A group begin their descent, their wingtips dipping into the water. One makes a rather ungainly landing, but then settles on the surface, flapping its wings and wagging its tail feathers. The setting sun casts a golden glow over the river as more swans come into land, pushing their legs out and skidding in on their flat, webbed feet. Colin is making a sketch of a swan's head.
They must use up a huge amount of energy on that flight. But when they get here, they're as graceful as when they took off. You swear that they just come from down the road. They're just looking absolutely perfect and pristine. Some journey to undertake. But one thing's for sure, when they arrive here, there's loads of food. They're vegetarians, they come here to feed on the grass. It's what they like to eat, and there's no shortage of grass in Ireland.
A swan rises up on its feet, flapping its wings and stretching out its neck. Another repeats the movements. more birds have joined the swans and dip under the water to extract tasty morsels. A swan chews on a blade of fresh green grass from a patch adorned with glistening dewdrops. More swans feast on the foliage jutting out of shallow waters, bubbles forming around their submerged beaks. A group of swans glide effortlessly through a corridor of orange light, reflecting off the surface of the crimson-tinged river. The shadows of racing clouds pass over a patchwork of fields that have been partially flooded.
We tend to spend so much of our lives indoors now and in cars. We may be losing touch with those sort of seasonal markers which give you a sense of the time of year and where you are. You know, our houses are probably as warm in winter now as they are in summer, and we eat any kind of food we want at any time of year. So those sort of traditional markers of the seasons are sort of disappearing. But in the natural world, of course, they're very much still there. They're still driven by the climate, angle of the sun, day length, all those things. That wonderful sense of a year, something cyclical.
A red squirrel harvests moss from the underside of a branch, while a bird in silhouette prepares to take flight from a stalk. It joins others with speckled bodies flying between tall stems. Colin is sitting on a camping chair outside a tent. Storm clouds are gathering, and Colin writes in his sketchbook, "The first snow of the year." Fields are blanketed in white, and a wandering fox noses the frozen ground. More snow falls, and a bird perched on a branch suddenly takes flight. Another bird with black feathers and an orange beak makes a swift exit. One bird puffs itself up against the cold, while another with a pale fawn-coloured breast scampers across the snow. Ducks swim alongside a bank of reeds frosted with snow.
This is a rare cold snap and it won't last long. As soon as the temperatures rise, things will start moving again.
Melting ice drips from reeds and posts into the river water. Colin gently paddles his canoe along a stretch of almost still water, which perfectly reflects the sun and the clouds. He deftly manoeuvres the craft, the bow of which creates only very slight ripples as it cuts through the water. The throat of a frog on the bank pulses slightly.
That's a great sound. Guess to lots of people, bird song is the first sign of spring, but for me, it's the croaking of the frog. Breeding season has begun. Male frogs, lots of them, calling to lure in the females.
Dewdrops splash on a frog's head.
Males await the arrival of the next female. This is an annual opportunity and they want to make the most of it. Some of these little males have spent the winter at the bottom of the pond, hibernating there. It means that they're in position, they're in the breeding pond when the females arrive in springtime. Females could be scattered out over this entire area. Something wakes them up. The same sort of cues, I guess, that wake up the males, wake up the females. They've been wintering under stone walls or under bits of boulders or under logs. And some of these females have to make this arduous journey across the land laden with eggs. Some sort of instinct drives them back towards these breeding ponds. And then it's the calls of the male that lure them in.
The thin skin under a male frog's throat bulges as it gives out its mating call. Other males join in the chorus as a female leaps gracefully on her way to the pond. The female lands belly first on a moss-covered rock as she continues her arduous journey. The males sit in the pond water, croaking mournfully, as the female crawls across a stone marked with white algae. She bounds onto a bed of springy, red-tinged heather as even more males appear to emerge from the depths of the pond. The female is finally closing in on the pond.
The poor females, you've got to feel sorry for them, because all these males have only one thing on their mind right now. She's on the edge of the pond and she's thinking, oh, will I, won't I? And when she makes that final jump in, all hell breaks loose.
The female waits on the edge of the pond, her eyes glistening. Then she takes the plunge and the males immediately perk up in response to her presence. The female finds herself at the centre of a tumultuous confusion of slick bodies as the males bundle her. She kicks her legs to no avail.
And these little males, what they're trying to do is they're trying to grab the female. They have special pads on their little hands, and what they're trying to do is get into the right position. They will wrestle each other, and she is stuck in the middle.
The male frogs form a sloppy pyramid as they all attempt to mount the female at once. Some of them seem to be getting a little confused and climb on each other in their mating frenzy. One lucky suitor appears to have latched onto the female, even as she attempts to crawl away with him clinging to her back.
Once they're really tight on there and in the right position, they will hang on for dear life. For the next few days, they will not leave her. Life for a female frog is not very easy. The other males sort of know and they give up. Right, she's taken. And then they wait for the next one to arrive. Love, frogs.
A frog appearing to be wearing a cloak of frog spawn. Colin looks up from writing in his sketchbook to watch a flock of birds fly overhead. Now he's back on the river, cutting a path through stalks jutting out through the water's surface. Birds swooping above quivering stalks are cast into silhouette. Colin paddles along the river.
Every evening this happens. Small flocks of little starlings come together to form bigger flocks.
The pale lavender sky begins to fill with starlings.
Just remarkable how so many birds come from the entire surrounding countryside. They all make their way back to this one little spot.
A squadron of starlings make their way across the sky.
When those flocks start to wheel just a few minutes before they actually hit the reed beds, there's just those extraordinary abstract patterns. From a distance, they could be, I don't know, a swarm of locusts or a swarm of bees. It's very hard to get a sense of scale.
A great cloud of starlings creates giant patterns in the sky, first looking like a flying saucer, then a toadstool with a thick stalk, and for a brief moment, the starlings seem to make the shape of one huge bird with its wings outstretched. Individuals frantically flap their wings as they come together with thousands of others to form a swarming pack silhouetted by the darkening sky.
In many ways, this is the greatest natural spectacle in Ireland.
It's just some sight. And the sounds of myriads of beating wings.
Colin gazes up at the undulating waves of birds. They all change direction instinctively.
It's better not to analyze things like this too much. Sometimes you just want to sit back and enjoy.
The cloud of starlings form ribbons in the sky, with dense patches where the birds have clustered most tightly together. The flock is reflected in the river water as they form a whale-like shape that seems to swim across the orange and purple sky. They break apart, then reform to create a floating lozenge, then a moving wave that rolls across the evening sky. Colin watches them from the best seat in the house, his canoe, at the water's edge. As the sky turns red, the cloud becomes denser still as the starlings make a leisurely descent to their feeding ground, still cutting a swathe above the vegetation. They sweep past behind a curtain of tall reeds.
Amazing sight, just amazing.
Colin continues watching until the cloud disappears. A dewdrop falls onto a sheet of black water. Sunlight glistens on the surface of the flowing river, and in speeded-up footage, red skies give way to a golden vista.
My journey is coming to an end now, and I've learned so much along the way. I've experienced this river in every season. I've gotten to know its moods, gotten to know its creatures. Somehow it's sort of gotten into me. It feels like it's a part of me now. It's no longer a river. Kind of my river.
Colin paddles his canoe through a wispy layer of light mist.
Well, it's our river. Its future health and well-being is up to us.
Colin continues on his way, lightly dipping his oar into the scarlet-tinged waters. Mm-hmm.